It's 4:06 and you're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, in for Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up on Wisconsin Life, we'll talk to a UW professor and vegetable breeder who develops new strains of beets and other vegetables.
First, yesterday union workers at Kohler Company in Wisconsin went on strike for the first time since 1983.
United Auto Workers Local 833 represents about 2,000 Kohler factory and plant workers. 94% of members who went to a meeting at Sheboygan South High School yesterday voted down Kohler's offer, which the firm called its last, best, and final offer.
Chuck Kornbach has been covering this topic for Wisconsin Public Radio News, and he's with us now to give us the details. Chuck is WPR's reporter based in Milwaukee. Chuck, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you, and good afternoon.
So you are joining us from Kohler. What's going on there today?
Yes, I'm just at the corner of School and Highland Drive with several dozen picketers from the UAW standing outside this site, which is just across from the Kohler's American Club. I've driven around the entire Kohler complex this afternoon. Big place, as many people know, in Kohler, west of Sheboygan, and there's protesters, picketers at just about every entrance or exit, especially out on the highway where the white-collar workers, the managers, and so on were driving in and out of one plant gate today. So there's folks all around the plant, dozens each side, I would say.
So Kohler Company offered what it called, quote, its last, best, and final offer, end quote. What did that offer to workers include?
Right. Well, the SheboyganPress.com or Sheboygan Press newspaper is reporting the company proposed a three-year contract with annual pay increases and bonuses to help cover the cost of health care premiums. The key thing here is there are two tiers of workers, T-I-E-R, two tiers of workers, people paid around $20, $21, $22 an hour. And then there's a lower tier work group of workers paid around $12 or $13 an hour. The long-timers have are paid tier A, so to speak. The short-timers or newer employees are tier B. The folks that have been here a while at Kohler would get, according to the Sheboygan paper, about an annual wage increase of about 50 cents an hour in each of the 3 years. The Tier B workers, the younger workers, so to speak, less experienced, would get an increase of an average more than 20% immediately with 40 cent per hour increase the second and third year. But it's a controversial proposal for many reasons.
And so what specifically about that two-tiered wage scale do the workers not like?
Well, what's happened, you know, this started about 5 years ago when Kohler and the UAW signed a contract, and there were some folks not happy with going to a two-tier system then, but it's been happening in the auto industry, for example. UAW and the auto industry dealt with that as well. Now some other companies have started phasing out the lower tier, trying to bring the younger workers up closer to the experience pay level. I think the UAW here at Kohler would like the lower tier to go away. They say there's not much of a ladder up to tier A, the higher tier, and so what about the future? What about our kids that we'd like to have working here someday? Are they really going to make, you know, $15 an hour someday versus their parents making $21 or $22 an hour? So it's quite controversial. We have some audio there with you, and one of the persons I spoke with a little while ago is a 20-year-old who she's worked there at Kohler for 18 months only. Her name is Alyssa DeVoe, and Alyssa was saying that, yeah, it's tough to make it on $12.69 an hour.
Let's take a listen to that.
Yep. If someday I wanted to have a family, or if I wanted to get my own apartment or my own house or take out a loan for a house or a car, I wouldn't really be able to because I can't afford living on what we make.
So, Chuck, you said that some other unions have been able to negotiate getting rid of or lessening the difference between tiered levels of employment, but it sounds like this is something that Kohler Company is sticking pretty hard to.
Well, so far, I mean, the union is saying that, listen, we did this when times were tough post-Great Recession 5-6 years ago. Things supposedly are better now. As far as we know, the company is making better money. Why not share some of that with us?
We're talking with WPR News reporter Chuck Kornbach. He is joining us from Kohler, Wisconsin, where he is covering the United Auto Workers Local 833 strike that has been called. It affects 2,000 Kohler factory and plant workers. Now, Chuck, you said that the workers and the union have been willing to go along with Kohler's conditions before because the economy was not that great. What are they pointing to say that, you know, this is different and we need different terms at this point?
Well, just that the general economy overall, the U.S. economy is better. Employment is up. Fewer places are closing down, although there's certainly pockets where manufacturers and other companies are closing up shop. But the union is suggesting that at least into the last few months, the economy has been better. Why not share some of that with us? Now, the other issue, if we can sort of go into, is this pay issue. One older worker that I talked to, is saying that, listen, yeah, you're offering pay increases, but health insurance costs are going to go up, and the bonus you're suggesting you're going to give us isn't going to cover the health insurance issue. The worker we spoke with, but you have audio there, is Bob Demers.
Let's take a listen to that.
Well, they give you the raise, but then they take it away in the insurance and that. You know, the insurance, they raise the deductible so much that you're not going to see the raise at the end of the 3 years. You're going to be back where you were before.
And, Chuck, my understanding is that what the company was offering was bonuses that would help to defray those costs. But, of course, a bonus is not something that is guaranteed moving forward.
Well, that's true, and we've certainly seen that in other sectors of employment where you're offered a pay raise, but the health insurance costs are going up. It sort of swamps the pay raise. It's not an uncommon complaint workers are having these days.
So, Chuck, the last worker strike at Kohler Company was in 1983, and that one lasted 16 days. Do we have any idea how long this strike might last?
Well, I've tried to reach the company, and they haven't been saying much. They have suggested to other media that they have an alternate production plan. Some of the union members say, well, they were, you know, working harder to build up a stockpile of items prior to the strike, so maybe the company has some inventory to deal with. You know, it's hard to say how long Kohler will want to hold out. One of the union members suggested he heard today that the company wanted to get back to the bargaining table, but I have been unable to confirm that, and I have not seen that reported elsewhere. You know, it's been a fairly nice day in Sheboygan County in terms of weather, 50 degrees and so on. How the union members react to colder temperatures and rain and so on in the next few days may be more telling, but the company, you know, is again, it's sometimes these things are an image, right? Does a company want to look like it won't pay its workers a higher wage? And sometimes the company says, yeah, we don't care, and they go ahead with that. Other times they do back down after a while.
Using the term last, best, and final offer certainly sounds like Kohler Company officials are signaling, you know, there's really not room for negotiation.
Well, that's, I think, a common thing. You know, we haven't heard some of these terms in quite some time because labor disputes are less common these days, especially the big ones. But that's a frequent term that was used decades ago, and I guess to still trot it out once in a while. I guess we'll see, because it's a little hard to predict what's going on inside the Kohler Company right now. They're evaluating, I'm sure, a few things.
So, Chuck, to wrap up, the influence of unions is diminishing in the United States and certainly in Wisconsin after the passage of Act 10. Do you think the Kohler strike will be less effective because of this larger context?
I hate to predict that. I will report what another gentleman said, what another striker said to me a little while ago, because I sort of asked the same question you're asking, and he said, listen, we are going to employ what we can. It's not a pleasant prospect for us out there, but we're going to use the tools that we are been given to try to press the company on this. And it certainly seems that there are some committed strikers to this. What goes on the next day or two, or maybe a few days, it's a little hard to predict, but the company is saying one thing. The union members are expressing firmness in their resolve.
Chuck, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
That was Chuck Kornbach, WPR's reporter based in Milwaukee. He joined us to talk about the worker strike at Kohler Company in Kohler, Wisconsin. He was on the ground there. It's the first strike there since 1983.
Araceli Esparza's grandmother picked vegetables for canning factories here in Wisconsin. Among the vegetables she picked were beets, which stained her hands with their color and their smell. Araceli tells us about how the smell of beets unleashed memories of her grandmother's hands.
Honoring las manos de abuelita y el movimiento de César Chávez y los trabajadores. Betabel. Betabel rojo, sabor de tierra húmeda, la cual nunca he probado antes de hoy. Lo curioso
honoring the hands of my grandmother and the movement of César Chávez and the workers. Red beet, the taste of a wet earth, the one I've never tasted until today. The curious thing is that I already knew your taste through the hands of my grandmother who long ago picked you. She pulled you from our mother earth. She picked you in the camps of Nebraska and the fields of Wisconsin, and your color stained her hands. Your smell permeated her skin, and I remembered her in the taste and smell of a beet. I know because today I smelled you beet, and with the taste in my mouth of the humid and wet mornings, once again I was there, hugged by her, mi abuelita. I wrote this because I wanted to honor the work that my grandmother has done. You know, growing up, she told me about the unions, about caring for my neighbors, about caring for those who didn't have, and to cherish what we did have. I know she was also part of the César Chávez movement of, like, very much against the pesticides that were used. And I guess I wrote this poem after eating beets that were given in a class that I was substituting for. The beets were from a community garden program that gives their harvest to schools with a high percentage of children on free reduced lunch programs. None of them had tasted beets, the children, that day. And I thought I hadn't either. And the moment the bag was opened and we passed out the snacks, the entire room filled with her, mi abuelita's smell. Just that earthy morning, that fresh, like it rained last night and you can just feel things growing, right? I held back the tears while eating one and I watched the kids inspect them, eat them, admire their color. And I knew then that it wasn't my first time eating one. I just never knew I had. Te jaló de la tierra madre, te piscó en los campos de Nebraska, en los fieldes de Wisconsin. My grandmother is 92 years old, and I'm sure her longevity has a lot to do with beets.
Tu color manchó sus manos, tu olor se impregnó en su piel. Recordé a abuelita con el sabor y olor del betabel. Lo sé porque hoy te olí, betabel, y con el sabor en mi boca de la tierra de las mañanas húmedas, y otra vez estuve allí, abrazada de mi abuelita, ella.
Wisconsin Life is produced by Erica Janik. It's a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more online at wisconsinlife.org.
We just heard about the common red beet that most of us might be familiar with, but we may not know there are a lot of different kinds of beets, and they're developed right here in our state.
Joining us now to talk about the world of vegetable breeding is Erwin Goldman, professor and chair of the Department of Horticulture at UW-Madison. Erwin, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks so much for having me.
So what kinds of work do you do in the Goldman Lab?
Well, actually, we're incredibly interested in the earthy flavors of beets, and that's something that was spoken of so beautifully in the poem we just heard. The beet is really about a sensory experience, I think, and a big part of that is the earthy scent and the earthy flavors that they have.
And you said that there's a name for that particular quality.
The compound that we're smelling there and tasting is geosmin, which means earth scent. Mm-hmm. And that is ubiquitous. It's in all the soil everywhere in the world. Every time you turn over soil, or as the poet said, when rain, the smell of rain, as rain drops hit the soil, that earthy scent rises up. And it turns out that beets have a strong association either with the bacteria that produce geosmin, or perhaps the beets have those bacteria inside of them that allow them to be more earthy.
Wow. Now, before we get more into the science, and we just heard a poetical take on the beet, do you feel that too? Do you have that kind of attachment?
Absolutely. It is a sensory experience, from the color that runs on your hands and all throughout the plate, and to the scent. It really is a vegetable that I think people interact with in a very deep way. It's one of the reasons I love it.
So how did you first get involved in vegetable breeding, specifically breeding beets?
Well, actually, UW-Madison has a long history of working with the canning industry. And the canning industry goes back 100, 125 years in the state. And in 1949, the Department of Horticulture began an active program to breed new varieties of beets to supply the canning industry. And the person who did that retired, and when he retired in the early 90s, I joined the staff and have been doing that work now for 23 years here.
So what makes a better beet? And I assume context is everything. I assume the answer is partly depends on what you're looking for. But what kinds of things do you try to improve in a vegetable like the beet?
Great question. You know, for some people it's about sweetness, and some people would, you know, don't mind the earthiness, but they really want sugars. Some people don't want any earth scent, and they really want something very, very mild and sweet. For some people, it's the color, and we have yellow beets, and we have pink beets, we have striped beets, so they really are attracted visually to it, especially when you cut it open. And for other people, they like a roasted root vegetable, a savory flavor. So we breed for all those different tastes and all those different sorts of consumer ideas.
It seems like one of the advantages of beets and maybe other root vegetables is that often you have to sacrifice flavor for being able to be transported a long distance. So tomatoes and some fruits, they're trying to get them with sturdier skins, and maybe they don't taste as good, but beets are pretty hardy little vegetables.
They are, and of course, you know, people think of one of the images people have of them, of course, is the huddled masses bringing their root vegetables with them. And of course, that's part of the history of them. They're great storage vegetables. Whether in a root cellar or in a garage, they preserve for a very long period of time and really can be consumed throughout the winter.
Talking to Erwin Goldman from the UW-Madison Department of Horticulture, talking about breeding beets and other root vegetables. So how do you do it? What techniques do you use to build a better beet or carrot or what have you?
So you know, a big part of this is taking a plant that's a biennial. A lot of people wouldn't really interact with the beet or the carrot after the root comes out of the ground. But what we have to do is take that root and store it for about 10 to 12 weeks in a cold temperature. It's called vernalization. And once it comes out of that, we plant it in a pot in the greenhouse where the whole second part of its life cycle takes place, which most people don't ever see. Mm-hmm. The plant flowers, it produces beautiful flowers. We then pollinate it and make crosses, and we harvest seed the following April that we put in the ground again. So we take a biennial plant and make it into an annual for the purpose of breeding.
So talking about the different types that you might be choosing to do that process with and then crossing them with others, how do you know, you know, I'm guessing that there are many different kinds of beets that have X factor that you're looking for. How do you know which ones to mix so you're not losing out on other qualities?
That's a real challenge for any plant breeder. I mean, some of it is luck, where we make hundreds and hundreds of crosses and hoping to find the right one. And other times we have some insight, whether by studying the genetics of the crosses we're going to make, we know we're going to get a certain type. So it depends on the situation. But a big part of plant breeding is trial and error. And we have to taste them. We have to share them with others to taste. We have to measure traits, and it's an actually fairly laborious process to find the one that we want.
I actually remember being at the Science Festival one year, and you had quite the array of beets there for tasting, and it was amazing how different the different flavors were.
They really are. I mean, it's, you know, there's some beautiful old heirlooms. There are some, you know, now we have wonderful colors and wonderful flavors. So a big part of what we want to do, and I think this is true for all of horticulture, is to try to find ways to connect with the consumer about the things that they love, the tastes, the smells, the colors, all of that. That's really what it's about.
What amazes me is we're in the age of genetic modification, and it sounds like at least a lot of the tools you're using are the same things that Gregor Mendel would have used back with his, were they pea pods?
That's
back
right.
In the day?
That's right. I mean, where certainly one could do this with very sophisticated technology. Our program is really based on classical breeding, the old techniques really that have been around for thousands of years. And for plants like this, where selection is so visual and it's so much about the consumer experience, that works beautifully.
So you're talking about the consumers, but, you know, beets have been around for a long time. Do you see trends in how the consumer taste has changed over the decades? Are people looking for a different quality of beet now than they were maybe in the 50s or the 40s?
Yes, you know, when Martha Stewart did a piece on beets at some point in the mid-90s, I think, you know, where she's pairing it with goat cheese or roasting beets with rosemary, that really did change some consumer preferences, and people started looking at this vegetable in new ways. Whereas in the 50s, we might have been more interested in canned beets or soup with beets. Now there's many more modern takes on it.
I got to ask, what's your favorite way to cook, eat, and serve beets?
My wife has created this wonderful recipe, which really is to blanch them for a couple of minutes mm-hmm. and then peel them and roast them in a baking dish in the oven, very, very high heat, about 450 degrees, covered with a little olive oil and salt and pepper.
I've done the oven roasting. I don't blanch them first, though. What does that do?
I think it just speeds up the process and makes it a little bit easier to cook them.
Wow.
But I think the roasting is wonderful, and it kind of, if you sear the outside, you get all that flavor on the inside. It's wonderful.
That sounds great. Do you also use beet tops, and is that something
Absolutely.
That, is that something that you're also looking at as far as what qualities you're looking for?
Very much. I mean, we've been very interested in the beet tops for nutritional purposes. They're also quite beautiful, but they have a lot of B vitamins like folic acid. They have beta carotene in them. They're really they have some excellent nutritional profiles as well as tasting wonderful.
Well, thank you, Erwin, so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Erwin Goldman is professor and chair of the Department of Horticulture at UW-Madison. We've been talking about his work on breeding beets and other vegetables. There was another presidential debate this weekend, this one featuring the Democratic candidates. We're seeing a lot from candidates in these debates and in media coverage in general. But are voters getting the information they need to make informed decisions when the primary voting starts next year? And are there key issues being overlooked?
There are often criticisms of horse race coverage from the media, vague policy platforms from the candidates, and too much focus on personalities and unimportant issues. On the other hand, millions of people are watching the debates, so they could potentially be valuable ways for voters to weigh their options.
Susan Johnson joins us now. She's Associate Professor of Political Science and Assistant Dean in the College of Letters and Sciences at UW-Whitewater. Susan, welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Rob. Good to be here.
Before we dive into some issues, you actually pointed me toward an article making the case that whatever the two parties are talking about, the candidates are talking about, it's not the same thing. We're seeing two alternate universes here.
Right. I was referring, as I sent you an article from the New York Times about a month ago, and it was looking at the debates and the kinds of issues that were being covered in the Republican debate and the Democratic debate, and particularly in those early ones, and just looking at some of the issues and how the issues that were highlighted in the Democratic debate, for example, there was a lot of talk of the environment, minimum wage, income inequality. There was discussions of gun control in that debate. And then in the Republican debates, some of those issues were discussed, but the main themes of those debates were a bit different, with immigration being a major issue, lower taxes, Planned Parenthood got a lot of attention. So there's been a bit of a divergence, I guess I would argue as well, in terms of the kinds of things that are being discussed in those debates.
Is that something that gets sorted out in the general election, or is this a reflection that we have more and more, at least politically, two Americas who look at the world, who look at the country and see two different sets of problems?
When the candidates are speaking during the debates, they're speaking to the primary electorate. And in the case of both the Democratic Party and the Republican Party, you tend to have a more polarized electorate in the primary. So you've got more conservative Republicans who would be mobilized in a Republican primary, and the same would go for Democrats, with more liberal Democrats being energized. And that's just how primary elections work. So you have the candidates, I think it's somewhat purposeful that we're seeing different issues highlighted in different ways in each party's debates, because they're speaking to their voters. And so I believe that when we get to the general election is when we're going to see a lot of these issues, where the eventual nominee will really need to get a bit deeper into the issues.
Well, let's focus in on the economy. That is one thing that's come up in debates on both sides of the aisle. A lot of candidates have been able to speak their piece, maybe in broad strokes. What do you make of the talk that we've seen on economic issues so far?
I think the main theme that we see from the Republicans is that we need lower taxes and a flatter tax rate. And from the perspective of the Democrats, the big issue seems to be minimum wage and income inequality. And these issues have crossed the debate, so we've seen the Republicans asked about the minimum wage, and we've obviously seen the Democrats asked about issues related to taxes and the like, but we're seeing the candidates putting these issues front and center in different ways. And I can think notably about the minimum wage and the kinds of responses that we saw from the Republican debate last week versus what we've been hearing about the Democrats. It's not necessarily surprising, but it's something to look at as we move forward.
So as they bring these up, are we getting much in terms of detail, or are these broad strokes saying, hey, we'll sort out the details later, but here's our marker, here's our philosophical position on this issue?
I think we're getting general, I would say in many cases, platitudes. I think that the Democrats have been fortunate because there's fewer of them. And so in the Democratic events, the forum that was held two Saturdays ago and then last Saturday's event, there's three people involved. And so just by virtue of that fact, they're able to speak much more in depth about their issues. Now, that can be a blessing and a curse, because if you're trying to be general and vague and attract the largest number of voters possible, maybe you don't want to spend 10 minutes talking about the ins and outs of your tax policy or something else. If you contrast that with the Republican debates, and there were eight people on the stage last week, but that's still a lot of people, and each one is trying to get their message out very briefly, but you can only do it in quick sound bites. Lower taxes, flat tax, eliminate the IRS, put all our tax law on three pages, just to kind of get that sound bite that's going to get media coverage afterwards.
Talking to political scientist Susan Johnson from UW-Whitewater about the presidential race, the issues in it, maybe issues that aren't getting the coverage that they need. You can weigh in, by the way, at 800-642-1234. What do you want to hear from the candidates? What do you want to see more detail about? 800-642-1234 is the number. And Susan, I want to get into what voters need to know, want to know, in order to make an informed decision. What kind of things do voters need to make that decision?
Well, I think that each voter is going to be different in terms of what her or his priorities are in terms of the issues. In looking at some of the key issues, I was looking at a poll that came out recently that looked at what some of the key issues are, and they tend to be a lot of the same issues that we've seen before. So the economy, terrorism, immigration, the environment, healthcare, and those are the kind of standard key issues. I think that for now, if we're speaking particularly to the primary electorate, I think that candidates in either the Democratic electorate or the Republican electorate are looking for the kind of information that would show them which candidate, I think two things, most closely aligns with what their position is, but also, at least I would hope, which candidate's ideas seem to be the most plausible in order to enact. And maybe we're not at that point where we're actually thinking about plausibility right now, but down the road, hopefully, that'll become more of something that we're talking about.
Well, maybe this is a kick-the-tire stages for voters now where, hey, we'll try this candidate on for size. They've got bold ideas. And maybe that's okay. We're trying it on for size, and we'll look for that plausibility test later when it's time to vote.
I think maybe. I mean, I think for some of us, as I sit and I watch the debates and I hear a lot of these broad generalities, I get a little bit frustrated. And then also it was interesting in the Republican debate last week where Rand Paul was trying to take some of the other candidates to task for speaking very broadly. And I appreciated that, because he was bringing up some issues and saying, you can't do both of these things, or how could you argue in favor of this? What are you going to do if X, Y, or Z happens? And I guess I wish there was more of that. So you're right, in a certain sense, there's kicking the tires, but you're almost kicking the tires, and I feel like there might be a curtain that's covering the car.
We'll go to a caller now at 800-642-1234. We've got Tim on the line in Eau Claire. Tim, hi.
Hi. What I'd like to see out of at least the coverage is a more uniform coverage. What I mean by that is it seems like if the media doesn't take a candidate seriously, we'll say Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump, they choose to look at other candidates. When realistically, Bernie Sanders is a top contender at this point for the Democratic nomination, and Donald Trump is still a top contender for the Republican nomination.
Tim, thanks a lot. And there's sometimes that herd mentality in journalism, like, oh, candidate X is surging the polls. We need to focus our attention on them. Do you think we as a voting public would be better served by trying to treat all candidates as equally as possible, not trying to determine early on, especially who's serious and who's not?
I think Tim's right, especially when we don't always know. Things change. Things are fluid, and it's possible. People have been predicting the end of Donald Trump since Donald Trump got in the race, and he's still around. Now, does that mean he's going to get the nomination? I don't know. I tend to think that he's not. But the fact is that if you presage every story with a suggestion that Bernie Sanders is unelectable, that sets the narrative almost for people. So I think that in a certain sense, candidates get tagged with these labels that then make them seem as they're not legitimate candidates or unelectable candidates. And then that does those candidates and it does the voting public a disservice.
We're talking to Susan Johnson, UW-Whitewater political scientist, about issues that may not be getting enough attention in the presidential race.
And you can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. What do you want to hear from the candidates that we're not already hearing? What issue do you think needs more coverage and conversation before votes are cast? And what do you need to know before you decide to support a presidential candidate? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We continue our conversation with political scientist Susan Johnson from UW-Whitewater, talking about issues that may be undercovered in the presidential campaign.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you want to hear the candidates talk about? Is there an issue that's being overlooked in the race? And what makes your decision when you vote? Is it the stance on particular issues? Is it detailed policy proposals? Or is it leadership style, moral vision, or other intangibles? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll go back to our callers with Carolyn in Madison. Carolyn, hi.
Hi. First, I just want to check. It seems to me I remember the League of Women Voters ran the debates initially, when they first hit television, starting with Kennedy and Nixon. Am I right about that?
Susan Johnson, do you know?
So the general election debates are different than the primary election debates. And so the League of Women Voters has, in the past, been involved in organizing the general election debates. But the primary debates have been organized, at least in the years I can remember, via the party. And that's why the Republican Party debate structure this time is different than the Democratic structure in terms of when they're being aired, how many there are, participation, and things like that.
And Carolyn, you had a question beyond that?
No, I just wondered.
Oh, that was it. Carolyn, thanks so much for that call at 800-642-1234. And Susan, I wonder, before we go back to our callers, is there something about, we're not so much trying to figure out their policy package, their proposals, maybe even their ideology. We're trying to figure out how they will be as leaders, those intangibles I mentioned a few minutes ago.
I think to a certain degree, when candidates are being vetted or they're introducing themselves to voters, there's a lot of different things that people are trying to get a handle on, because in many instances, these people are unknown, particularly people who haven't been on the national stage, and even some who have been on the national stage aren't necessarily known to the general public. So the candidates themselves are trying to do many things when they're presenting themselves to voters. One of those is making sure that their broad policy positions are out there to attract the greatest number of voters in the primary electorate, but then also to, you're right, show that they're strong leaders. And some of that comes out when you think about answers to questions about terrorism or leadership on the economy. There's a goal to move beyond just what my tax plan is to more about how I would articulate that vision and implement that.
Let's go back to our callers. Chuck is on the line in Green Bay. Chuck, hi.
Hi, how you doing?
Good. What did you want to bring up?
Well, I'd like to see both Republicans and the Democrats talk about the world economy, about how it's affecting us, and what they would like to see happen to you know, enhance our economy.
Chuck, thanks a lot for that call. And Susan, a complicated issue, maybe more complicated than candidates would want to go deep on, especially given, you know, the domestic economy alone is tough enough to give details on.
Right. And I think that sometimes when we talk about trade agreements, for example, and the Trans-Pacific Partnership came up in the Republican debate as one example where Donald Trump and others tried to bring that up to bring up the global economy. But I think that you're right. In many instances, voters don't necessarily understand the ins and outs, and it's not their responsibility to necessarily the ins and outs of the economy. But I think that one of the things that the candidates should do is speak more to how our economy is tied into the global economy and thinking about issues that are important to voters, both Republicans and Democratic voters, indicate that the economy is the number one issue. Now, when you're thinking about the economy, you're generally thinking about your pocketbook more than anything else and not the pocketbook of anyone else, even around the world. But I think that candidates could do a better job of speaking about how our economy is integrated into a global economy.
Chuck, thanks a lot for that call. Catherine tweeted us to say she'd like to see the media cover how a candidate could work with a hostile Congress and deal with gridlock. Well, there's a question about how a president would actually function as a president.
And yeah, I think that speaks to leadership. I think that one of the issues when you ask someone that question, you can really sense by their answer about how willing they are to work across the aisle. And it's interesting because I think that what we see in the current political environment is more and more candidates who are willing to say that they're not necessarily interested in working across the aisle. I'll be curious to see what happens once we get to the general election, but I can't think of a time historically where you would have candidates so boldly talking about not engaging. And I'm thinking about a few of the candidates who are in the Republican primary. I mean, Ted Cruz is one very good example of someone who has been quite strong in saying that his own party has been acquiescing too much to the president and to the Democrats. And so that is something that actually candidates are differentiating themselves on, which I find really interesting.
So there's a lot we want to learn about our candidates, policy, personality, politics. Are these debates, as they're currently constituted, a good way to learn these things?
Again, I'll go back to the point I made earlier. I think that on the Democratic side, they are, again, only because there's just fewer people involved. And it's just really difficult when there's 10 or 11 or now 8 people on the stage over a 2-hour period of time to get each candidate to speak to the same issue and provide an in-depth answer and then demand appropriate follow-up, so to get beyond just some of the talking points. So I'm hopeful that as the pool winnows on the Republican side, that perhaps we'll be able to get more of that as well.
And short of that, do we, what, stack up their policy statements and settle in for a long fall evening read?
Well, there's not a whole lot out there in terms of policy statements. If you go to their websites, in some instances, you've got just bullet points. Other candidates have come out with more detailed policy proposals on certain issues, taxes, for example. But there's not a ton out there for you to see. It'd be a short read.
Susan, thank you so much for joining us today.
Happy to.
That's Susan Johnson. She's Associate Professor of Political Science and Assistant Dean in the College of Letters and Sciences at UW-Whitewater.